The 2008 campaign for the presidency was the longest, the costliest, and many feel the most exciting race in modern political history. It produced a seemingly inexhaustible cast of characters of an implausible variety, 141 candidates, 21 of them serious contenders, and a host of supporting players, including a controversial preacher, an obscure governor who became an overnight political celebrity, lots of pundits, and even a few comedians. These stories have been condensed into the first comprehensive history of the 2008 election by Dan Balls, the lead political reporter for the Washington Post, and Haynes Johnson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who's now a professor of journalism at the University of Maryland. Their book, The Battle for America 2008, is published by Viking. It's my great pleasure to welcome them to our show. Hi.
Thank you. We're glad to be here.
Hasn't every minute detail of the 2008 election already been covered in exhaustive detail in print, on the web, on television and radio? Did you find it hard to come up with things that hadn't been written before?
Actually, no. The strange thing about this election was that the more you got into it, the more you realized you didn't know, the more you learned about the characters involved, what they were going through, and the tensions and the frustrations and the strategies and so forth. Instead of just covering the daily events of political flow, it was constantly changing, and we were constantly being surprised.
And we're still hearing some of the bickering. Some of the people involved in the McCain campaign and Sarah Palin, and he says, she said, was this stuff that people talked to you about after the election?
Yes, they did, and a lot of that is in the book, and it continued long after our book went to bed. But you know, one of the interesting things was, this campaign was lived in real time and, in, as you suggest, in almost minute by minute. And what we had an opportunity to do was pull it apart and put it back together and tell it whole. And in doing that, we think we've not only been able to enrich the story but also bring things to light that are relevant today as well as at the time of the campaign.
Well, Dan, over the course of the campaign, you produce stories almost daily. Were a fixture on weekly political television shows, and I was wondering if you reserved some special things knowing that you might be writing a book.
Well, absolutely. We did a lot of interviewing as we went along.
And did you know the two of you were going to collaborate on it from the start?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We joined forces in February of 2007, and at that point set out a game plan. And one of the agreements that I had with the newspaper was that I would be doing some book-only interviews along the way, mostly of events that had already happened and had settled that the Post had already covered. And people were willing then to talk more freely about some of it, knowing that it wouldn't come out until the end. So we have a lot of, I think, fresh material that goes beyond what I was doing every day in real time for the Post.
And the reason we did the book, basically, wasn't just another political book, although that certainly it was that. It was because we both believed that this was the most important election in our lifetime because of the stakes in the country, because of the problems that people felt, the alienation from politics, the divisiveness, the polarization, the sort of two wars that were going on, the economy was in trouble, and this sense that politics wasn't working. So you were looking for something. It's a test of the American character. That's what we were trying to do.
But it's interesting. I was thinking about something Theodore White wrote in the preface to his book, Making of the President, 1960. You could have written it in this book. He said it was the atmospherics of 1960 more than anything else that made it possible for John F. Kennedy's political exertions to triumph over the many divided parts of the American people.
And that's exactly what happened in this last election, too. Finally, Obama was able to reach out and convince people that they could take a chance and gamble that he was the president. But it took that.
David Axelrod argued in an early 2006 internal campaign memo that Senator Obama was uniquely suited for these times. No one among the potential candidates within our party is as well positioned to rekindle our lost idealism as Americans and pick up the mantle of change. Of course, he was working for Barack Obama. But can Barack Obama's success be largely attributed to his ability to capitalize on this particular historic moment?
Well, it was a unique moment in history. You had had 8 very difficult years under President Bush. The country was not just divided, but the country was hungry for something different. And that Axelrod memo, which we have in the book, was one of the first that said, in the 2008 election, after what we have gone through, people are going to look for a replacement, not a replica. And you, Senator Obama, he was saying to his friend Barack Obama, are best positioned to do that. He's fresh. He's new. He had opposed the war from the start, which none of the other main Democratic candidates could say. So Axelrod felt rightly that there was a unique opportunity there.
And it was more than opposition to the war. His 2002 speech, which opposed the Iraq War before it became unpopular, also criticized attempts, I'm quoting, to distract us from a rise in the uninsured, a rise in the poverty rate, a drop in the median income, to distract us from corporate scandals and a stock market that has just gone through the worst month since the Great Depression. This is 2002, the 6 years.
I know, and it got worse, of course. And as we wound on, it got worse and worse and worse, and the public began to feel that more and more and more.
That speech is even more interesting as you read it 5 or 6 or 7 years later than it was at the time.
And yet, I must admit, when I interviewed him in 2004, I didn't think of him as a potentially serious candidate because, to be honest, he was black and he had an odd name, and I thought that would hurt him.
Yeah, sure. Well, anybody coming then in that year with the middle name Hussein, and he was also a black candidate named Barack Obama, you know, you have to say it's odd that he's going to be able to have a chance, but he did, of course.
We talked to him about the issue of race and why he thought or what he thought about whether that would be a real barrier to his getting elected. And he said, you know, he said, I thought the country was ready. He said, when I ran for the Senate in Illinois, people said, well, Illinois is not going to elect somebody like you with that kind of a name and African-American. And he said, they were fine. He said, I believed if I could do that in Illinois, I could do it in the country.
On the other hand, as you point out, there was growing dissatisfaction with the Bush presidency and the war in Iraq. But there were also demographic changes in the makeup of battleground states that some might say preordained a Democratic victory, although some comedians joked that following tradition, the Democrats were sure to screw things up.
Yeah, I don't think the Democrats would say it was preordained. They might have believed that, but they haven't had much luck in that sense for a long time.
But will those demographic changes make for a new Democratic majority of the sort that Karl Rove predicted when he was talking about a permanent Republican majority?
There is some potential for that, although I think predicting permanent majorities in this country is
well, long-term.
Well, here's what you've got.
Got to get voters as enthusiastic in future elections as they were.
Right.
In
I mean, this was a unique election in many ways, but there's no doubt that there are demographic forces. If you look at the Rocky Mountain West, the rise of the Latino vote has made that a much more purple, if not blue, area than it was. Parts of the Midwest are now leaning more Democratic than they used to be. The Republican Party, as we now know, is a much more Southern-based party with very little elsewhere. And the youth vote, which came out so strongly for the Democrats, is only going to grow in the next 4 and 8 years. That's a much more diverse group than in the past. And with a country that has become more diverse, a Republican Party that is still largely a white party is going to have trouble.
And the Latino, Hispanic, however you want to define it, that's the largest now minority in the country. And it's like 43% of the population, more than the black population, Asian. So you put all that together, you're seeing a changing America. And it's going to keep changing as you go forward. So if you're only going to be a white party based in the South, basically, that's not very helpful for the future. That doesn't mean they can't win the Republicans, but it's a change. It's a challenge.
My guests are Haynes Johnson and Dan Balls, and their book, The Battle for America 2008, The Story of an Extraordinary Election, published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Theodore White also wrote that though later historians would tell the story of the quest for power in 1960 in more precise terms with greater wealth of established fact, there might nonetheless be some permanent value in the effort of a contemporary reporter to catch the mood and the strains, the weariness, elation, and uncertainties of the men who sought to lead America. And you both had a unique vantage point for this election. What were the daily realities of the campaign like?
Dan, you was chatting with the candidates all the time. I was talking to voters and candidate officers, holders, and so forth.
You split the responsibilities.
Yes, I spent those 2 years literally on the trail with a lot of the different candidates. It's the most remarkable election that I have ever covered. for a variety of reasons. One, as Haynes said at the beginning, the stakes of the country. Second, the cast of characters. And third, the unpredictability of events. I mean, no one anticipated that the contest between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton would play out the way it did, with so many twists and turns, with such drama, with so many unpredictable events, that as a reporter, to cover it in real time was literally a daily challenge and yet, you know, an exhilarating experience.
It was the first time in 50 years that we didn't have an incumbent president or a vice president running for office. And usually we assume that those are great preparations for the next winner.
That's right. It opened up even more, made it more volatile and so forth. So the changes, the demographics, all these changes, the issues in the country made it a special election. And it kept changing as we were watching it. You talk, the one thing that you look back on, you quoted that thing of in 2002, what Obama was saying about the country. In the background of this election was a ticking time bomb. That is the collapse of the American economy. It hadn't collapsed in 2002, despite what Obama said then. But by the fall of 2008, it had. And there were fears that we're going to face not only a depression, maybe a greater than the Great Depression. So when that happened, all the stakes, all the anxiety, all the concerns, all the issues about America's place in the world, about who we were, could we trust politicians, can government work, I'm going to lose my health care, I'm going to lose my benefits, my job's going to be gone. All of those intensified and gave it an additional stake to the election.
Barack Obama in particular seemed slow to adapt to campaigning at first. You report that in the summer of 2007, he could find nothing positive to say about the experience. And on the Republican side, Fred Thompson seemed reticent to submit to the hardships of the campaign.
Let me talk about Obama first. Obama came into this, as Axelrod wrote in that memo in November of 2006, as the hottest commodity in politics. And yet his first months on the campaign trail were very, very difficult.
Because of inexperience?
Yes, very much because of inexperience, very much because Hillary Clinton was more prepared to jump into a presidential campaign and began at a much higher level of performance than he did, partly just the sheer physical exhaustion, partly he missed his family. There were a whole series of factors, but you noted that point about in the summer he couldn't find anything positive. He had a conversation with one of his aides, Robert Gibbs, and Gibbs said, well, just find something that you like and focus on that, even if there's a lot that you don't like. And he said, there's nothing I can find positive. And his aide, Reggie Love, who was in his mid-20s at the time, was working his BlackBerry, and he looked up and he said, boss, if it's any consolation, I'm having a blast. And Obama looked down at him with this withering look, and he said, Reggie, it's not. Now, Fred Thompson's an entirely different case. Fred Thompson
thought that he would be the Ronald Reagan kind of candidate, didn't they? Because
sure.
He was an actor, and he knew how to deliver lines.
And he had a moment, but I think he waited too long to seize the moment. There was a time, just as John McCain's campaign was imploding in the summer of 2007, when clearly the Republican race was totally scrambled, and it gave an opportunity to everybody in the race. And had Fred Thompson, A, jumped in at that point, and B, been ready to run a real campaign, which it's not clear that he was, he might well have had a real impact. But he missed that moment, and when he got in, he was unable to really campaign the way he should have.
Yeah, he never capitalized on his opportunity, and he held back. And the idea that he was lazy, you could say that, maybe not, but he certainly wasn't in there aggressively pushing the way the others were.
And then once he became a joke, whenever any candidate becomes a joke, it's hard to get past that, isn't
it? Yeah, once that happens, you're done.
He made a terrible first impression and never recovered from it.
You write in the book that the final chapter of Clinton's campaign could be said to have been the best time of her candidacy. Why did it take her so long to, in her words, find her voice in a race that had been pretty much choreographed since 2006?
That's a very hard question to answer. It did happen, and she started out partly because we're the inevitable winner. We had the most money. We had the best operation. We were part of a team that had won the White House twice for the Democrats. Now, no one since Roosevelt had done that, and so forth. So there was confidence, among other things. Also, she was cast as, because she's a female candidate, that she had to be seen as strong, commander-in-chief strength. And then she also supported the war in Iraq. And she never was able to get away from that. And then things started falling apart. And only when she began losing, she all of a sudden became liberated and freed, and she became, as Obama says to, in the book, telling us that she was a frighteningly good candidate, and she was really connecting with voters. She was humorous. She was a terrific candidate toward the end when it was too late.
Well, why did it take so long? We've heard in previous campaigns that the advisors have really hurt some candidates. Is that what was happening with her?
Well, I always
why did she take so long to disavow her position on Iraq, for example, when it was apparent that it was hurting her with a large portion of the Democratic base?
Well, part of the answer to that is that there was a concern inside the campaign that because there were questions about what did she really stand for? Did she stand for anything? Was she simply somebody who would do and say whatever it took to get elected? That if after so many months of not backing away on Iraq, that if she had done that, it would have played into that stereotype that she was doing it simply for political reasons. And they reached a point in the campaign where they concluded she can't do that. But she did everything possible to have no daylight between her and Obama. But she was stung by that problem.
There's always that problem that politicians seem to have, that they're afraid to admit that they may have been wrong at some point in the past.
Yes, of course. And that's understandable, I guess. And you don't want to admit that, and particularly in a hard-charged campaign and with the stakes. And she is ahead in the polls. She was way ahead. She was like 2-1 at one point there. And overconfidence comes in, and then there was disintegration in her own campaign apparatus. So it all worked against her.
There's another aspect also that feeds into that, and that is that nationally, she was doing quite well through most of 2007. In Iowa, she was never doing that well. Iowa was always her most difficult state. And so ultimately, the first battle was in Iowa, and she failed that test. And as a result of that, it completely upended the race.
It's been said that the rigors of running a large presidential campaign are some of the best tests of a candidate's leadership capacity. Do you agree?
I do agree with
yes,
that.
Absolutely.
Yes, and that's why I say I think the problems in a campaign, while we often attribute it to advisors, are always a reflection of the candidate, good and bad.
Well, was the length of the campaign beneficial then for the insight it gave into different candidates' managerial skills?
I'm not sure the length of the campaign helped anybody, frankly, because it was so long and so expensive and so draining. And we start campaigning. The minute you finish one election, you start campaigning for another one. And that means you're campaigning to run a campaign, but not to govern the country. That's a very difficult position.
Although I would take some issue with that in this sense. I think theoretically—
I'm glad the two of you disagree.
We don't agree on everything.
We have differences.
For this reason, I think theoretically that's true. The campaign was too long. However, the length of the campaign clearly benefited Barack Obama.
Oh, yes.
Because he was able to learn from his mistakes. He was able to grow as a candidate. He was able to demonstrate strength and resilience over time that had it been a much shorter election, he'd have had more problems.
And you devote an awful lot of this book to a dissection of the primaries, which we will come back to after we take a little break. My guests are Dan Balz, the lead political reporter for The Washington Post, and Haynes Johnson, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, now professor of journalism at the University of Maryland. Their book is called The Battle for America 2008, and it is published by Viking. We're back with Dan Balz and Haynes Johnson, their book, The Battle for America 2008, published by Viking. And as I said, you devote most of this book to a dissection of the primaries. Is that where the race was won and lost?
Yes, I think that's right. When we talked to Barack Obama after the election and asked him size up the competition, he said, we always thought the semifinals would be more difficult than the finals. And he said, that's not because we underestimated John McCain, but we knew that Hillary Clinton was an extraordinarily strong candidate.
But his campaign efforts began with an office of just four people. And that looked like he didn't have a chance.
When you look back on that, it's such an extraordinary fact that he started with no money, no organization, the smallest resume probably of any candidate in our times.
He was a junior senator,
and he hadn't
even served one full term.
Two years as a senator and then state senator in Illinois, and one great speech before the Democratic Convention and earlier on the Iraq War, but that was it. He had no great legislation history that he marked out, and the fact that he became president, given what he started with, is an extraordinary story. It says something not only about him, but about the country.
You're right that Idaho is a textbook study of the Obama campaign. So what did he do right in in Idaho?
Well, Idaho is a symbol for the difference in the approach between the Clinton and Obama campaigns in how they contested the caucus states. Most of us think of these nomination battles as contests in big states, Ohio or New York or Florida or California. But in fact, the caucus states were decisive in this battle. The reason is that the allocation of delegates, and I won't get into it because it's too convoluted, makes it attractive for a candidate like Obama to work the caucuses. And let me give you two examples, with New Jersey being one, which was a primary state, and Idaho being the other, a caucus state. There were 107 delegates at stake in New Jersey. Senator Clinton won that state easily. She netted 11 more delegates out of that pool than Obama. Idaho, a tiny state with a total of only 18 delegates at stake, Obama ran away with that caucus, and he netted 12 delegates. So he got one more delegate out of that pairing of states, and that happened repeatedly through that month of February.
But I've never understood why caucuses are the way to go.
Well,
I would think a straight vote, like a primary, makes more sense.
Well, we disagree on that one, too, about that. I happen to think it would be better if we had regional primaries, maybe five in the country, and you take one area and then the vote is counted.
The Northeast, the South.
Northeast, the South, Southwest, so forth. Dan feels very strongly, equally, and that the caucuses are a great test of the candidate in the areas to find out who they are locally and so forth. So we both agree that the process needs to be reformed.
I think that there are flaws in the caucus process because they can be exclusionary just because of the way the timing of them and what you have to go through to do it. But Iowa in particular, the most prominent caucus state, is a place where people take their politics quite seriously and they run the candidates through their paces in a way that doesn't happen in other states.
But the current system is just so expensive, isn't it?
Every system would be expensive. There's no question that this was the most expensive election in history. But there is no way that we're going to go back to a situation in presidential politics in which we're down to small dollars. This is a big, costly enterprise.
And all the years we've been covering American politics, which is a long, long time, more than I want to even recall for either of us, the politics of money has been an issue, and it keeps getting more. Despite all the attempts to reform it, we're going to do this campaign reform, and it keeps getting more and more expensive, and the candidates start earlier and earlier. It means you've got to raise the money, otherwise you can't do it. And so there we are.
And we're already hearing about candidates raising money now for the next election.
Yep.
This is earlier than ever before.
You have to start early. I mean, what's happened in the last several elections is that the system of public financing, both for the primaries and for the general election, has been totally shredded. There used to be limits on what you could raise and spend to win the nomination and then what you could spend in the general election. The winning candidates in the last several cycles have opted out of that system, including Barack Obama.
Of the criticism of John McCain, it was a weird kind of thing where in the past, Democrats complained that the Republicans had the advantage because they could opt out and Democrats couldn't. And here we had the whole thing reversed.
It was a moment that reminded us that those decisions about whether to opt in and opt out have nothing to do with ideology or philosophy. They have everything to do with taking political advantage of where you sit. And for Barack Obama, who was able to raise more money than any candidate we've ever seen and raise more in small amounts of money. For him, the decision politically was opt out.
Well, the image is that he got it all in these small donations, but he got a lot of big contributions.
Sure he did. Of course he did.
But he also did get – I mean, their ability to tap the internet was the envy of everybody who was running in 2008 and everybody who has ever run for president.
And who will in the future. They're going to study the Obama technique, the campaign, for its lessons, and they will use those lessons in the campaigns to come.
The FEC has reported that over $1.5 billion was spent over the course of the campaign. That sounds like that's big money. That's like the bonuses they give at Goldman Sachs.
I think the amount of money that Obama raised online was roughly $500 million. I mean, it's staggering.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, it's interesting that the McCain and Clinton campaigns went through rough times. These were the most experienced candidates of the lot.
And
Hillary's took a lot longer to recover from than McCain's.
Yes. Now, Senator Clinton's campaign team was a very talented group of individuals. As a team, they were often dysfunctional. They fought among themselves. They could not settle on a particular strategy. They could not resolve certain issues. They would come back and back, for example, to the question of, should we attack Barack Obama or should we not attack him? They litigated that and relitigated that and relitigated that. And at the crucial moments of the campaign, particularly after Iowa, despite the victory she had in New Hampshire, in that January and February period, they were almost a dysfunctional unit.
What if John Edwards' extramarital affair had been exposed earlier? Might Hillary have had a better chance?
We believe, we'll never know for sure, but yes, it certainly could have made a big difference.
She would have picked up a lot of his voters?
Perhaps so, and it would have opened up an opportunity. And because he was there, and he started out very powerfully strong in Iowa, which was an important factor. So that was one of the things that, had it happened, it might have changed the outcome.
You report that Hillary Clinton later was to say in a private conference call, "I'm doing what you all asked me to. Every time you ask me to do something, I've done it. Would you just give me a clear understanding of precisely what my mission is here?"
This came after the loss in Iowa, which for them was a staggering loss. They always feared they would could lose Iowa. They didn't expect to lose Iowa. The last thing they wanted was to lose to Barack Obama. They were prepared to lose Iowa to John Edwards. They felt they could recover from that fairly easily because he had less places to go after that. With Obama, they knew that if he won Iowa and if she finished third, as it happened, she was in big trouble. And that night there was a long, hard discussion, and she was frustrated. And in New Hampshire, basically took the campaign back on her own shoulders.
Mark Penn, who was on this program last week, wrote to Senator Clinton in an early memo that voters don't care about private character, only public character and what a politician can deliver. Was it this estimation that lost Hillary Clinton the nomination in the face of Obama's attractive and compelling personal story?
Well, no, it wasn't a factor, but it certainly did reflect a cast of mind that did not take into account what was happening in the country. What Obama had going for him was the desperate hunger for change, and we're in trouble in America, and here's a fresh new face. And people wanted to look at that and see if I can take a chance and gamble on this new figure. Do we feel comfortable with it? Do we feel confident about him? And it wasn't the other factors. I mean, he had something going for him that was compelling and fresh.
Well, when Senator McCain launches the race, he said, "I know who I am and what I want to do." And then, as the campaign went on, his message seemed to become muddled, and people were asking, who's the real John McCain?
Well, the truth was, when he opened his campaign with those words, he really didn't know himself at that point. I mean, he had gone through a kind of a metamorphosis from 2000 to 2007, which is when he announced, from an outsider and a maverick and a very singular figure to somebody who was trying to consolidate the Republican base, and he was struggling with that himself.
You quote President Obama saying, as early as 2006, the election would ultimately come to oppose the war hero against snot-nosed rookie. So why did the narrative of the election turn out so radically different?
Well, John McCain turned out to be a somewhat different candidate than Barack Obama assumed he would at the time, and the conditions in the country were just so favorable to the Democrats that it made a different election out of it.
And one of the reasons, as writers, as journalists, as authors, whatever you want to call us these days, but looking at this campaign, such an extraordinary cast of characters, and looking at the changes that they went through, it was compelling to watch it and to try to follow and figure out what was happening. And there it was. I mean, McCain started out, Dan said early on that John McCain was a Shakespearean figure in that he was trapped in a Shakespearean way because by the prisoner of war. His whole legacy was the ordeal of being a POW
in
Vietnam.
And they trotted it out every chance they could.
But then he also became a captive again in his presidential run by defending the war policies of George W. Bush, who had crushed him. So he was trapped in this thing.
A friend of ours said, when you read through this book, what you see is three characters, McCain, Obama and Clinton, all with a potentially fatal political flaw, and only Barack Obama figured out how to solve it.
Dan Balls and Haynes Johnson have written The Battle for America 2008. It's published by Viking. People complain that policy issues weren't adequately addressed in the campaign. Did you feel that was true?
Well, in a nomination battle, issues often matter less than personalities. The Democratic Party, for example, was far less divided in this primary contests than they have been in some in the past. So the real issue was, which style of leadership did people want?
And the Republicans had immigration as a really serious divisive issue, didn't they?
They did. And it cost John McCain dearly in May and June of 2007 and led to the implosion of his campaign.
On the other hand, we did have the health care issue, which got a lot of people excited about the Democrats, Paul Krugman waging a campaign against Barack Obama. What about that? I mean, Hillary Clinton came up with a really comprehensive plan, and Barack Obama remained rather hazy. And right now people are complaining that Barack Obama has continued to remain hazy on health care.
The whole idea of the issues and so forth is a fascinating one because, you know, one of the problems is the way we run these campaigns, and journalists are to blame for this, the debates and so forth, are so short. Attenuated, that you don't have time to explore fully an issue like health care or the military or the economy. So you have snippets. You have 60 seconds to respond to a problem. And it's very hard to make the case of why it's important. And Obama is struggling with this right now.
But Dan, you reported in a 2007 article in the Washington Post on a poll which said 70% of Americans overwhelmingly favor the idea of finding a way to cover everyone, even if that means raising taxes, and that two-thirds of the public supported a government plan. Where's that sentiment today?
Well, what happens in these when this current fight over health care started, I think everybody within the battle felt that the climate for comprehensive health care reform was better in 2009 than it had been in 25 or 30 years, in part because of that there was a sense that among all participants, not just people who didn't have insurance, but people with insurance and businesses, that the current system needed to be overhauled. What we've found once again is that as you get into the details of this enormously complex issue, it is very easy for opponents to pick one piece of it or another piece of it, raise the specter of problems, and that begins to take root. And that's what President Obama is going through now.
But that's what happened during the campaign, wasn't it? They were cherry-picking statements by Barack Obama, by John McCain. Sarah Palin was being picked on, and she was picking on other people.
Sure, but the health care thing is fascinating because here you have this most complicated issue. I think you could make the case, if we did that same poll again today, people would say we still want health care reform, but the conditions now facing the country. You have unemployment rising. You have the fear of what's going to happen. I lose my job. I lose my benefits. All these anxieties, and therefore, can I afford what this great reform is going to be? And that makes it very difficult for Mr. Obama now.
In the past, we've heard complaints that the media play too big a role in how things turn out because they determine a narrative, and then we live by that narrative, even if the narrative is unfair. Did that happen in this campaign?
Well, to some extent it does. It's part of modern politics, and it's certainly part of modern governance that the idea of a narrative is simply kind of what is conventional wisdom of the moment. And a smart candidate knows how to stay on top of that, and candidates who often lose are ones who get on the wrong side of it. And there were times when all three of these candidates, of the main candidates, were on the wrong side of it. And Obama, in the end, was able to put himself on the right side.
And speaking of the narrative, Mr. Obama clearly had the right theme change. That's the oldest theme in American history. It's nothing new, nothing reflective that tells us we're in a different time, except that it fit the time. It fit the time exactly, that we desperately wanted change because of all the things we've talked about. And he alone among those candidates understood that and kept talking at it. And so he would say that, and back came the crowd. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. And so there was this symbiosis going on, and it worked to his advantage.
Another complaint people have had in the past is that too much of politics is poll-driven. Did we see that in this campaign?
Well, all of politics is very poll-driven. Now, is it too poll-driven? One could argue that for many days and months. Polls are simply a way of trying to understand what public opinion is, what people are really thinking. There are many ways to measure that. Good campaigns figure out what they really want to talk about, what themes they want to go to, and figure out then what's the best way to do that.
We haven't even mentioned Sarah Palin, but we're going to have to leave that out because we've run out of time. You can follow up on this if you want to, because Dan Balz and Haynes Johnson will be speaking and signing books tonight at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store on the Upper West Side. That's at Broadway at 82nd Street. The book, The Battle for America 2008, The Story of an Extraordinary Election, it is published by Viking. And, gentlemen, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today.
It has been for
Thank
us, too.
You. It's been
Thank
great.
You.
Remember, this is New York Public Radio, WNYC. On tomorrow's show, Paul Giamatti and director-writer Sophie Barthas on their new film called Cold Souls, and then a look at a program which uses soccer as a way to help people move out of homelessness, plus Representative Henry Waxman on why everything and nothing is happening in Washington this month. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Nicole Silbersack, Sherry Shin, Barbara Kahn, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.